And the thing that so many entrepreneurs get wrong is even when they do that work to understand the job framework that they're solving, they don't market it using that language. So they market it with, look at my app. Don't you want to see a demo? Like, isn't this so cool? Just see the app and you'll understand. And unfortunately, nobody buys an app just to buy an app.
And welcome back to another episode of Angels, Exits, and Acquisitions. My name is Jeff Barnes. We just spoke with Claire Milligan of Aimably, and she is on a quest to solve a really big problem that I didn't even know was actually a big problem for a lot of companies in the cloud computing and software space. And we talked a lot about financial transformation and what it takes to take companies and in the private equity space and mergers and acquisitions and all the little nuts and bolts and how you go from being on the engineering and software side of the house over into the financial and business growth side of the house. So if that's you, be sure to tune in and listen to this incredible journey.
Welcome to Angels, Exits, and Acquisitions, the place to learn how to fund, scale, exit, and massively profit as an angel investor or entrepreneur. Brought to you by the Angel Investors Network. And now, here's your host, Jeff Barnes.
Hey there, welcome back. This is another episode of Angels, Exits, and Acquisitions. I'm here with Claire Milligan today. Claire, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing wonderful. Thank you very much. And I'm really excited to talk to you about our the topic today on today's episode, because you and I were just talking about how your background and my background are somewhat similar. I started out running a nuclear power plant on a submarine a long time ago, and then technology, and I was all into engineering and operations and technology. And now I'm in a part of my career where I'm doing a lot with when it comes to finances and investing and acquisitions. And sounds like maybe not the submarine part, but you have a little bit of background on the technology side as well, right?
Absolutely. I came up through product management and software. And as we acquired and merged with a lot of different companies, I directed my focus to finances.
Awesome. Well, it's one of those things that I made a transition in my career a long time ago, because I saw the writing on the wall. There's always going to be new tech coming up, new ideas, new innovations and things like that. But if you don't understand how to take that and apply it into making money, it doesn't really do you a lot of good. So I'm really curious to hear about your story and how you went from, you know, being in product management when it comes to software all the way up into, you know, private equity and maybe even financial engineering now.
Cool. Yeah, it's going to be fun. I'm excited.
Wonderful. So, you know, just give everybody a little bit of background about you and where you started and what kind of got you going.
Yeah. So my name is Claire Milligan, and I graduated from college having no idea what I wanted to do and fell into designing things. I was very much interested in graphic design. I was hired by a client of ours to be a product designer. And by the time I left that company, I had been the general manager of that line of business. And it was through a 10-year cycle of growth under angel investor ownership, then towards more sophisticated institutional investors, and finally private equity and a lot of mergers. And so my story became the last 5 years I've been working on a startup with my co-founder, who was also at the former company I was at. And we created our business to help companies understand why they're spending money on cloud costs and how they can control it, because it's so crucial when you're under financial transformation and private equity ownership to get that under control and to truly understand where they're coming from.
Awesome. So you've done something unique in the sense that you worked in a startup, you worked in companies that have been maybe funded by angels all the way up through institutions, then private equity and mergers and acquisitions. Most people don't experience that when it comes to their career, right? Like they might work for a large corporation, and sure, there might be a lot of mergers and acquisitions at the corporate level, but a lot of people, even in the day-to-day operations, aren't involved in that. And then there's the other end of the spectrum, which is the startup and, you know, bootstrapping and trying to figure out a way to get everything going, get off the ground. You've literally worked in the whole spectrum, it sounds like.
Yeah.
So I'm really curious. And, you know, is there an area where you find it more appealing? It's more fun without maybe being, you know, hair pulling out and stressful?
You know what? I think it's all hair pulling out and stressful, but I kind of thrive on that in a way. What I love to do is to learn more and solve something new, and to take kind of a complex problem and really like sift it out and pull the pieces apart. So I think that rather than preferring one stage, I prefer to evolve. I prefer to go through different stages. And it's funny, after this whole avenue from angel through to private equity, I've now come back around and bootstrapping on my own. So it's really the whole gamut is interesting to me as long as things are moving quickly.
Very cool. Yeah, I find that's true of most entrepreneurial people, is that there's never a lack of ideas, right? There's never a lack of innovation. And these people, you know, yourself, me included, we get bored if things stay status quo for too long.
Yeah.
And I really feel that a lot of entrepreneurs get this this bad rap of like having ADD, right? And I don't think it's that at all. I think it's that certain people really do operate at a level that, you know, consistency and stability is somewhat boring, right? And there's a whole world of people, probably like 95 to 99% of the world, that really enjoys going to work, putting in an honest day's work and getting paid for it. And they are perfectly content to live their life outside of work, right? And work is just the thing that they do to pay the bills. And then there's a small minority of people that are just crazy enough to say, no, my life is going to be my work. And I really, really enjoy being involved in that. It sounds like you might be teetering on that edge.
I'm definitely in column B. Yes. And yeah. It's funny that you mentioned ADD, because as I was starting my new company, I got diagnosed with ADHD. And so understanding that and helping it to format how I think and how I structure my day and make sure to take it as a superpower has been a learning experience.
Yeah, I can only imagine. So let's back up and let's rewind a little bit. You know, you started again, you know, graphic design and software and technology. Was there a point in your career when you said either somebody dragged you in kicking and screaming, or you said, yeah, I want to learn that, where you had to shift over to the financial aspect of a business and that side of things?
Yeah, absolutely. So there was a very distinct moment. We were bringing together... We had built up this company that was at the time called Certify. It was expense report software, and we were a whole bunch of former competitors that had come together. And I was the product management leader for that group. And then we were joined and merged together with a company called Chrome River, which was even bigger than what we were. We eventually became known as Imburse. And at that time, we had to make quick decisions about which former competitor and product lines needed to be the growth engines, and which needed to be sunset, and which needed to continue to thrive as cash cows. So we just did this, you know, whiteboarding session. And what that resolved it to was that the businesses that I had come up in from the beginning, which were called Tally and Spring Ahead, were the ones that needed to become cash cows. Their products would continue, their customers would continue, but the focus was going to be how can we drive profitability out of them. And of the people in the room, I was the one that knew all the details about how those businesses worked. And so I signed up and I said, you know, put me in, coach, let's figure this out. Hello. And I got really good at P&Ls and thought through all of the different ramifications for all the different solutions that we could adopt. And I found it really interesting. And it's a design puzzle. And it's something that was actually very similar to planning products. But that was really the moment where I understood that this was something that I could do, not just something that I was somewhat interested in doing.
And did you have to go back to school for any of that? Like go, you know, get an MBA and try and figure this stuff out? Because again, you know, reading a P&L and a balance sheet and putting these things together is a little bit far removed from even graphic design, especially graphic design.
Yes, it is. I did not go back to school. I like to joke that I got my MBA running through a fire. Right. I was part of a management training program that the private equity firm ran. It was like soft skills and hard skills in terms of acquisition navigation. But to be frank, we were expense report software. And early on in my product management journey, I realized I needed to understand accounting and bookkeeping in order to build correct software. Because the worst thing you can do is just deliver data in the wrong place. And so I learned all of this from Accounting for Dummies and Bookkeeping for Dummies. And I swear to God, they're fantastic.
They are.
And just leveraging that plus the management insights really got me to a new stage.
Before continuing, please subscribe and share this video to help us reach more people and stay notified of our latest releases. Now, let's continue watching and learning.
And you mentioned something that, honestly, I don't think anyone's mentioned on this podcast before, which is You have hard skills and soft skills. And for anyone who's been a manager or had to manage people, we understand those terms. And, you know, those of us that have gone through, whether it's leadership training or, you know, there's a term for retraining certain people, right? But I actually had to go through that too. When I went from, again, being that tech guy and that engineering guy, I say, hey, you're going to be involved in the business decisions at a really, really big company. You need to understand this stuff. And so they actually put me through, and a quick side note here, they put me through all this training. I had to go to like a 3-day leadership camp, and there was all this workshopping and back and forth and role playing. And at the end of it, they give you this like 40-page long thing that you're going to give back to your manager, and your management team's going to get this and assess your leadership capabilities. I said, Jeff, you did a great job on everything, and everything you did. And I attributed that to, you know, getting an MBA with a focus on leadership and being in the military and all that. Mm-hmm. I said, there's just one area that we're really concerned about. I said, well, what's that? And they said, it's your interpersonal sensitivity.
Oh.
And I was terrible at it. And I said, well, I don't see why that's important, right? You know, so they didn't find that too very funny. So I definitely had to go through that and learn those soft skills. But I found that learning that bit was actually more important than all the other skills of doing the tech or figuring out how to fill out a P&L or what does it look like on a, how do you read a QuickBooks, you know, a cash flow statement or a balance sheet? Because the soft skills were what allowed you to get the foot in the door in the first place. Right. To even have the conversations with the management team, with the investors, with the board members, whoever it might be. Did you find the same to be true for you?
Yes. And when they did the analysis on me, it turns out my emotional regulation can do a little bit better. So what I learned from that was,
they used to.
Oh, yeah. I can make you sound terrible. But what I learned from that is vent around the corner, come back to the meeting.
Right.
You know, the vent should not happen in the meeting and everything's going to be good from there.
And you know, it's one of those things that I was in my 30s at the time, you know, maybe even late 20s. I can't remember, but I wasn't really keen on doing all of this stuff at the time. I was like, this seems like a waste of time. And geez, why do I have to deal with this stuff? And it wasn't until I started having those executive level conversations with people where I realized why it was so important, right? Like, I don't know, think before you speak kind of things, right?
Yeah.
And sometimes you need to be reminded, hey, you did not do a good enough job of pausing, ingesting information, thinking about a solution before you opened your big mouth. And because you didn't do that, now we're in a situation where we have to go put out fires. Thank you so much. And I find that, you know, I work with a lot of entrepreneurs, and most entrepreneurs are terrible at that stuff. They say things without giving any thought to what the long-term ramification might be.
Yes. And often our society really celebrates that too, because we have notable names who have had incredible success and apologize not one moment for their personalities. And so that creates kind of a cult following and a belief that that's the road to success. And truly, those are the outliers.
100%. Not only are they the outliers, but they do think about what they say, right? And sometimes they are abrasive on purpose because it meshes their personality or their brand or what they're trying to achieve. And, you know, the polarization scale, if you can call it that, is something that they have mastered. Like, I know who I want to attract, and I know, and I also know who their enemies are, and their enemies are my enemies. So I'm going to throw stones at their enemies and they're going to love me for it. Right.
Yeah.
But it polarizes them dramatically, right? That, you know, there's the Elon Musk of the world, and he attracts a very unique avatar to him, and he detracts or pushes away everybody else. And that works out really, really well for him. It works out well for, you know, for folks like Donald Trump too, right? Attract somebody that he really wants to attract and pushes away everybody else. And I agree with you that, you know, there's this misunderstanding of a lot of people that see that and think, oh, they could just emulate that person.
Yes.
And they do it in such a terrible way because they don't understand the underlying cause, the reason they do that, right? And so I feel that communication and the way that you hold yourself and the way that you present yourself is vitally important, especially like you're seeing in the growth of your own business and building your own business and raising capital and all of those things.
Yeah. And in fact, you know, it's funny because then that cascades over to the hard skills, right? So if you're thinking about, hey, I'm bootstrapping and then I'm thinking about angels and all that, and I need to act like I'm a leader and have all those soft skills, then I also need to deliver board reports and analyze the financials on a deep level and communicate where we are as a business as if I'm a step ahead of everything, because then our business will succeed when we're all understanding where we are.
Yeah, 100%. And it's actually really a challenging line to walk, right? Because I coach entrepreneurs all the time, and some are very, very visionary and they have a great vision, but they can't distill it down into simple terms so that anybody can understand it. And that translates into, I struggle to raise capital because no one understands what I'm trying to do, right?
Sure. Yeah.
Or you have these people that do these just absolutely beautiful pitch decks and these amazing numbers and these amazing everything. And they're the most boring people in the world to listen to. And you're like, you know, believe it or not, you do need both, right? You do need to have that showmanship, that ability to communicate and interact and connect with people, but you do need to understand the fundamentals of your business too. Like, you can't just be pie in the sky all the time, right?
Yes.
So you have made a transition. You've done, you know, M&A at the highest level, hundreds of millions of dollars worth of enterprise value, putting these companies together. And, you know, then you decided at some point, I want to be an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
Walk us through, like, how does somebody go from, because I'd imagine, I don't know all of your story, but I'd imagine when you were involved at the, whether it's the financial engineering or what do you do with these products and these companies when they are operating that level, you're at the height of a career for a lot of people, right? Which is, we are trying to figure out strategically, how do we continue to grow these businesses and stay relevant in a really crowded marketplace and provide shareholder value, to all of a sudden having to go to being the bootstrap, nimble entrepreneur, right? And a lot of people look at that and they might go, why would you even leave that? Why would you do that? And imagine you had to answer those questions a few times.
Yeah, well, all the time. And I call myself an accidental entrepreneur because I did not say, you know, I'm going to go and build businesses. There are plenty of people out there who are like that, and I respect them. But in this particular case, it was this kismet of my co-founder, who I had worked with for years and trusted implicitly, was going out and he was saying, I want to solve this problem. And this problem is understanding cloud costs like AWS, Google Cloud, Azure, from an engineering perspective. And I said, oh my God, this is so important, because that was the one line item in the P&L that I could do nothing to. I try as I might, I could have changed, I could have negotiated new rent, I could have done a layoff, I could have done all kinds of things that would have changed the business except for that line item. And so I was like, well, this is what I was so focused on. I have to work with you and do this. So in that sense, it was just the most interesting opportunity that was in front of me at the time. And as I like to continuously grow and evolve, it was the right thing to do for me. But, you know, if I had not, I find being an operator and coming in and bringing together acquired companies and to create new financial plans for these businesses as they come together, that's a deep second passion of mine.
So it sounds like then, you know, again, going back to whether it's ADD or just wanting to feel challenged, like, this is a problem that no one else has solved and I want to solve it.
I really do feel that way. Yes.
Having worked in a lot of companies that you've been in, and I'm assuming you've been surrounded by other entrepreneurs as you're going through this journey, do you find that to be a common thread?
That's interesting. Yes, but it's usually about how they solve it rather than seeing the problem in a unique and novel way. And especially because I've seen companies come together that were addressing the exact same problem, and the founders are now working together and they all believed they had done it differently. And what was great about that when it came together is that everybody had their own track when it came to ideal customers. And so they connected well in a specific target market, and that worked great. And that was because of how they had solved the problem. You know, cloud costs, there are a bunch of startups out there actually that are trying to do this, and they are trying to do it from a perspective of building dashboards or automated tooling, and they're very engineering solutions for engineers. And so in the sense that I feel like we're solving a problem that no one else is solving, it's hard because the category we're in is one that's very saturated. And so now, as you've asked this question, I'm wondering, am I doing exactly what I'm talking about in that I just solving it a new way? But I really do think that the core problem is we need our business to be moving from X to Y, and we're doing it with a whole disparate bunch of people that have never worked together before, probably hated each other at some point in time just by like fiefdoms and things like that. And we need to make the financials look different for this business. And when it comes to software, cloud costs are the second largest line item to personnel. So it's, for me, as an understanding and having been through that process, it's just a no-brainer. You have to look at it with a company like ours.
So I'm going to read into what you're saying and saying that, you know, you had a problem. And I want to bring this up because it's really important, I think, for a lot of entrepreneurs as well as investors who are looking at investing in companies, which is so many people I have seen and I have worked with over the years have never spent the time to really analyze the problem they are solving.
Yeah.
They are so quick to jump to a solution-oriented approach that they think that the problem is really, really big. And yes. Like, you know, we use the example all the time of, you know, the person who is dealing with the struggle of, you know, let's just say putting a lunch together in the morning. And I'll use this example because it's a really funny one that friends of mine did during our MBA program. Was said, well, you know what the problem is? The problem is no one has enough time to have a good, healthy lunch at lunchtime when they are working in a big building, and no one has the time to cook because they got kids and they got that. Wouldn't it be great if we could set up a thing where it could make a sandwich fresh on demand and all organic and be really healthy for all this sort of stuff? And yeah. Wouldn't that be great? Because everybody wants that. And the problem with that approach was you went like an inch deep on what the actual problem was. Mm. You didn't actually get into what is the real problem that people are running into. And maybe the problem wasn't that they didn't have enough time during lunch, or maybe they didn't have enough time to make the meal. Maybe the problem really was, I didn't even know what I should be making to stay healthy when I have to sit on my butt 8 hours a day at work and don't have time to leave and go get, you know, a salad somewhere, right? You know, or maybe the problem was, no, I like to have salads every single day, but the containers I use are too big and bulky and it doesn't work for carrying, you know, whatever it is. But what you just said is, I was dealing with this because we're doing this for ourselves and for the private equity firms, and we're doing M&A as the second largest line item on the expense sheet. And I don't have any way to fix this. And all these other people are looking into it, but how in the world do we address that? And because it was such an important problem to you, I'd imagine it was an important problem to the other people. And I'd also imagine that you guys researched this a little bit more before you jumped in and just said, yeah, let's start a business.
Yes. Well, you know, so it's interesting. There's two sides to this, right? And as a product manager, we talk about this in the framework of jobs to be done. Understanding the job that happens regularly and is a huge pain point and how to solve it in the framework and understanding of that job to be done. And in our case for this, you know, we actually go to market by working with private equity partners and technology leaders to say, hey, how's your portfolio doing? Are you able to make these transformations as strongly as you can? Are you changing the gross margins of all of your businesses? Because that's where the cloud costs hit up at COGS. And so are you having these results and are you challenged in getting them? And once they understand, like, we are the avenue to full portfolio change, you know, they're immediately going to work with us. So in that sense, it's that jobs to be done framework. But the other side of it, and the thing that so many entrepreneurs get wrong, is even when they do that work to understand the job framework that they're solving, they don't market it using that language. So they market it with, look at my app. Don't you want to see a demo? Like, isn't this so cool? Just see the app and you'll understand. And unfortunately, nobody buys an app just to buy an app. They're buying a solution to a problem they're experiencing. And if you use their language back at them, they really understand what you're talking about.
Yeah, 100%. Ryan Levesque wrote a book a while back called Ask, and it's all about this, the ask methodology, right? And it was that same idea. And, you know, you talk about the lean startup and you talk about, you know, I think you were referencing the value proposition canvas there with Osterwalder. You know, what are the jobs to be done? What are the pains? What are the gains? What are the things that we're going after here? And for some reason, entrepreneurs who supposedly have read all these books, who have supposedly gone to the courses and gone to the seminars and trying to figure this stuff out, completely forget that when it's time to market their product, you don't talk about the product.
Correct.
You talk about what's in it for me from the customer standpoint. Like, what are you solving for me? And for some reason, it's so hard. I think it's because they've been so entrenched in the product development. Would you agree with that?
I do agree with it. Also, it depends on who you are selling to. When we sell directly to technology leaders, because sometimes we do, they're like, where's my free trial? I just want to look at the product. Just show me the product. I don't really care what you do.
That's me. I just give me a headline and give me a free trial so I can test it out and see if it works.
Exactly. And so there are certain markets where that's appropriate, but by and large, yeah.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about, you know, this problem that you're solving. You've hinted on it a little bit, but you're obviously starting up a company. I'm assuming, raising capital at this point, or will be soon if you haven't already. And you are trying to solve, well, I don't know if you would call it the second largest pain point when it comes to expenses inside of a large company, software, cloud-based company. But tell us a little bit more about what it is you guys are doing.
Sure, yeah. So we have a fundamental mind shift that has happened as a result of moving to cloud-based infrastructure. So the old model was, we're in a data center, we have physical servers, physical computers doing the work to perform the computing power for the customer that's signing in through the browser. And that was a capital expenditure. So you would know how much they're worth. There was a resale value, there was a depreciation process, and you could put off buying new. So your cash flow was a very understandable problem. And so you could really predict that. What's really crazy about cloud services now is that this has become a metering, individual charge, cents here, cents there model that hits your COGS expenses and happens on a regular basis, and the cash is due immediately. You have no visibility into how much is going on. Let's say an engineer decides to spin up a really complex data science model on a very powerful computer, then your bill is very much higher the next month, and it's coming straight out of the credit card, or it's due on net 15 terms. And so that's a very big challenge for making sure your cash is available, especially under private equity ownership, where there's often a lot of loans there, there's leverage, and you owe the cash to pay back on those at highest priority, even below those cloud costs. But when the cloud costs don't get paid, your business is out of business, right? So it's really a treasury management concern, but the solution is entirely technology. So there's this issue of, you know, finance trying to understand and saying, hey, this is a problem. And technology leadership who have been building this thing for growth, and they've been building it for capability and reliability, and so that they don't get woken up in the middle of the night if something's not performing the way it should. And so these engineers now have to change their mindset completely, and sometimes even work against what they think are their own incentives to make the systems far more lean. And so what we try to do is bring them together so they understand each other, and then model out solutions that are configuration-based and pricing-based that can really have a huge impact. I mean, we've never saved less than 20% for a client, and it's just all on the basis of not rewriting your entire code and just making it a really easy process for infrastructure change and taking down the level of concern and infighting between the two departments.
And so my thought on what you're doing here, because this is a complex problem, like you said, if it's, you know, somebody over here in the operations department in the software IT world, they're doing their thing and they're like, oh, well, I need to do this. I need to turn this lever and put this code in and build this sandbox. And all of a sudden that results in, you know, a 10% increase. I'd imagine the CFO is going to be a little bit upset, right?
Not only upset, but also feeling like their hands are tied behind their back, because right, there's nothing they could do about it. And when they approach the engineering team, the response is just, you know, we have other priorities. We're trying to deliver this feature for this customer. Grow, grow, grow. And so it can be hard to even think of yourself as a steward of the business when this is just something that you don't have any influence over at all.
That's interesting. So it changes, you know, going back to the how do you market something like this? It changes who you're even talking to, right? Because, yeah, you might be a solution provider for, you know, the CFO, really, right? The CFO just wants to have a handle on what's going on. But you still have to get buy-in from, you know, the CTO or the CIO, right?
Absolutely.
Try and get your software implemented or do an MVP, a proof of concept, whatever it is, just to show results, right?
Yes. And so often it's a question of timing. When we're not working through private equity advisors, when we are working with private equity advisors, there's a lot of pressure from the investors. So they have a lot of more weight when it comes to working with the technology teams. But when we're not, the sales cycle is quite extensive.
Sure.
Because you initially have a pain point with a CFO, but then the CFO is like, I don't know if I can even get you guys to talk to these guys. I don't know if they'll pay attention to me. And then, you know, we have this caricature in our marketing, like in how we do our sales process that we call DevOps David. And it's so crazy because there's always this guy at every company. He's probably the founder's like nephew or something. Not an engineer, but an infrastructure maniac, knows it all, but it's his walled garden. And you have to make sure that he understands we're not questioning him. He didn't do a bad job. In fact, he probably did a great job. But what we're faced here is a changing business climate, and we're the facilitators for him to get from one track to another and get to where the CFO and where the business needs to be going. So DevOps David is always a challenge for us.
So you just hit on something that I think is incredibly important for anybody who is listening, when they're going out there and they're going to market with any business, which is, you guys have done some really deep research on your buyer persona, haven't you?
Yes.
I find that, you know, when people throw up numbers about the TAM, SAM, SOM, and they're like, yeah, that's who we're going after. That's great. That's all well and good. But then, okay, who is your actual buyer? Who's going to be the person who's going to make that decision? And you just spoke to the psychographic nature of the person you're selling to, right? Not, I need to know what their title is at the company. Like, yeah, that's important. But who is that person? So that's pretty awesome. And most people have not gone down that path of identifying that enough, let alone we always tell them, give them a name, right? Like, mm-hmm. Give them a name. If you don't have a name for your avatar, then you haven't gone deep enough, right? And what does DevOps Dave do on a daily basis? You know, does he like to come in on the weekends? Does he not? You know, those types of things. And I think it's really important because until you've gone through that process, your sales team and everybody in that chain, that value chain, is going to be struggling to really do a great job for your clients.
Yes. And you really have to do founder-led sales for a period of time. Yeah. I really believe that you could build up these personas, build up these materials, and use the model that I had been working at when we were at $100 million in revenue, $200 million in revenue. That does not work when you're trying to create trust and you're a no name. They have to believe in you, the founder, and that you're capable of giving them a solution that is worth them taking the risk on you. And so not only do you have to get to that level, but I think sometimes some founders get there through their kind of own experience in the sales process, and that's okay. But you absolutely have to then have those materials to empower your salespeople when you're starting to work through sales employees.
And it is one of those things I will say is probably the biggest initial shift for any entrepreneur. Let's just say you get the company off the ground and you're making money and the founder is doing the sales and, you know, getting the customers in. And I've experienced this. It is the biggest and hardest shift initially when you say, okay, I want to hire a biz dev person.
Yeah.
And that biz dev person, I want you to take my, or even a CRO, take the revenue generation off of my shoulders so I can focus on the growth of the company. You just go sell the thing like we've been selling it. And then you see the sales just fall off a cliff, right?
Yeah.
And it's because they don't have the charisma, the way of saying things, the understanding that you do. Like, they don't have that historical knowledge. I love that you said that because the founder-led sales process is vital. So how have you navigated taking that from maybe being you and only you initially to hopefully eventually being a team of people doing it just as well as you do?
Well, I'm going to be totally frank. We started, I had a plan, we hired a sales team, and it is all my fault they failed because I just dumped the issue in their lap and said, hey, I'm just going to be in charge of what the software does. Don't worry about this. You go sell it. You know, that did not work. Unfortunately, they did not make their on-target earnings. And so then, you know, they needed to move on. And so now I am still the salesperson for our business. And we will get to a point where I will pass it off, but I'm probably going to stick with it longer than most people would. And the reason why is because I don't have a sales background. And in order to get to a stage where I actually give a team everything they need, I have to think a lot deeper about it and not just kind of dump it in their lap like I did initially.
Yeah, 100%. It's not a fun process for anybody, right? Because, you know, you and I are like, in the fact that we understand the operations and the engineering and we want to do that. Like, that's the part that's kind of enjoyable, solving the problems, right? But now you have to go and solve the problem for somebody else. And you can't do that until you convince them that you can solve the problem for them and get the sale, right? And then you can go on to, okay, now we'll solve the problem for you. But you got to convince them first and foremost. And, you know, it's not a fun process, but it's vital for the growth of any company.
And your own growth as a founder.
100%. Yeah. Yeah. If you're not growing and learning how to do sales and learning how to raise the capital and learning how to manage people and lead the teams, you're just like everybody else who might have a job and likes to go through the motions, but doesn't want to have to take the responsibility. So that's not what an entrepreneur's life is.
Nope.
Awesome. So Claire, thank you so much for being here. It's been a wonderful conversation. How can people find you and learn more about your company?
My company is Aimably. It's Aimably, and we're at aimably.com. I'm Claire Milligan, and you can spell Claire, Claire. I'm found on most social sites with the handle Claire Designs.
Awesome. Well, Claire, it's been a pleasure. We'll make sure we put all of that stuff in the show notes. I'm really looking forward to following Aimably and seeing how you guys are doing and growing. And for those of you who are watching and listening right now, do us a favor, like, subscribe, and share. And we will see you on the next episode of Angels, Exits, and Acquisitions. Thank you.